With the government of South Carolina now preventing the garrison from resupplying in Charleston, Anderson could hold out, Scott estimated, for only 26 days. It would require 6 to 8 months to assemble the fleet of war vessels and transports, 5,000 additional regular troops, and 20,000 volunteers necessary to resupply and reinforce the garrison. Rumors spread that Sumter would soon be surrendered, but Lincoln was disinclined to hasty action, Wells recorded in his diary, and wished time for the administration to get in working order and its policy to be understood. Repeatedly he called his cabinet into session to discuss the situation. He met with Francis Blair, who, like his son Monty, believed passionately that the surrender of Sumter was virtually a surrender of the Union, unless under irresistible force. That, compounding with treason, was treason to the government. At Monty Blair's suggestion, Lincoln met with his brother-in-law, Gustavus Fox, a former Navy officer who had developed an ingenious plan for relief by sea. Bread and supplies could be loaded onto 2 sturdy tugboats, shadowed by a large steamer conveying troops ready to fire if the tugs were opposed. Intrigued, Lincoln asked Fox to present his plan. And the next day, March 15th, the cabinet gathered around the long table to discuss the stratagem. Lincoln seldom took his seat, pacing up and down as he spoke. After the meeting, he sent a memo to each of the members, asking for a written response to the following question. Assuming it to be possible to now provision Fort Sumter, under all the circumstances, is it wise to attempt it? Seward, who had exerted himself in the previous months trying to mollify the Union's remaining slave states, found the idea of provisioning Sumter and sending troops to South Carolina detestable. From his suite in the old State Department, a 2-story brick building containing only 32 rooms, Seward drafted his reply, while his son Frederick, who had been confirmed by the Senate as Assistant Secretary of State, handled the crowd downstairs. In his lengthy reply to the President, Seward reiterated that without the conciliation measures that had solidified the Unionist sentiment in the South, Virginia, North Carolina, Arkansas, and the border states would have joined the Confederacy. The attempt to supply Fort Sumter with armed forces would inevitably provoke the remaining slave states to secede and launch a civil war. That most disastrous and deplorable of national calamities. Far better, Seward advised, to assume a defensive position, leaving the necessity for action in the hands of those who seek to dismember and subvert this Union. In that case, we should have the spirit of the country and the approval of mankind on our side. His emphatic negative reply probably reached Lincoln within minutes, for the State Department was adjacent to the northern wing of the Treasury Department and connected by a short pathway to the White House. Chase did not return his answer until the following day, repairing that evening to his suite at the Willard Hotel. Considering his hard-line credentials, Chase returned a surprisingly evasive and equivocal reply. If the attempt will so inflame civil war as to involve an immediate necessity for the enlistment of armies and the expenditure of millions, I cannot advise it. Better, he later explained, to consider the organization of actual government by the 7 seceded states as an accomplished revolution, accomplished through the complicity of the late administration, and letting that Confederacy try its experiment. Still, he concluded in his answer to Lincoln, it seems to me highly improbable that war will result. I return, therefore, an affirmative answer. Every other cabinet officer, save Blair, rejected the possibility of sustaining Fort Sumter. Bates argued that he was loath to do any act which may have the semblance before the world of beginning a civil war. Cameron contended that even if Fox's plan should succeed, which he considered doubtful, the surrender of the fort would remain an inevitable necessity. Thus, the sooner it be done, the better. Wells, writing from his second-floor suite in the Navy Department on 17th Street, reasoned that since the impression has gone abroad that Sumter is to be evacuated, and the shock caused by that announcement has done its work, it would only cause further damage to follow a course that would provoke hostilities. And if it did not succeed, failure would be attended with untold disaster. In like fashion, Interior Secretary Caleb Smith concluded that while the plan might succeed, it would not be wise under all the circumstances. Only Montgomery Blair delivered an unconditional yes, arguing that every new conquest made by the rebels strengthens their hands at home and their claim to recognition as an independent people abroad. So long as the rebels could claim that the northern men are deficient in the courage necessary to maintain the government, the secession momentum would continue. Just as President Jackson stopped the attempted secession of South Carolina in 1833 by making it clear that punishment would follow, so Lincoln must now take measures which will inspire respect for the power of the government and the firmness of those who administer it. In the end, 5 cabinet members strongly opposed the resupply and reinforcement of Sumter. 1 remained ambiguous. 1 was in favor. In the days that followed the cabinet vote, Lincoln appeared to waver. Weed later insisted that on at least 3 occasions, the president said if he could keep Virginia in the Union, he would give up Sumter. Seward urged that so long as Fort Pickens in Florida remained in Union hands, Sumter's evacuation would matter little. Pickens was fully provisioned, and, situated in Pensacola Bay, would be easier than Sumter to defend. Orders had already been issued to reinforce the garrison. However, Lincoln felt that the surrender of Sumter would be utterly ruinous, that at home it would discourage the friends of the Union, embolden its adversaries, and go far to ensure to the latter a recognition abroad. Desiring more information, Lincoln sent Fox to talk directly to Major Anderson and determine exactly how long his supplies would last. Through the intervention of an old friend who was close to the governor of South Carolina, Fox received permission to enter Sumter and meet with Anderson. If his men went on half rations, Anderson told him, he could last until April 15th. At the same time, Lincoln sent Stephen Hurlbut, whom he had known well in Springfield, to Charleston. Hurlbut had grown up in Charleston, and his sister still lived there. Speaking privately to old friends, he could test Seward's assumption that Unionist sentiment throughout the South would continue to strengthen so long as the government refrained from any provocative action or perceived aggression. Hurlbut spent 2 days in his native city. He returned with no hesitation in reporting as unquestionable that Unionist sentiment in both city and state was dead, that separate nationality is a fixed fact. While Lincoln was learning more about the facts of the situation, his cabinet colleagues were engaged in a series of petty feuds. Chase considered Smith a cipher, and Bates a humdrum lawyer. Seward was furious when Chase and Bates insisted on 2 appointments in his own district and stated that would be humiliating to him. "I would sooner attack either of those gentlemen in the open street," Seward indignantly wrote Lincoln, "then consent to oppose any local appointment they might desire to make in their respective states." From his Treasury Department office overlooking the White House grounds, Chase complained to Lincoln that Seward would certainly have no cause to congratulate himself if he persists in denying the only favor he can show me. Blair Sr., echoing the sentiment of his son, grumbled to Chase that all the best missions abroad had been given to Seward's old Whig friends. "I believe our Republican Party will not endure unless there is a fusion of the Whig and Democratic element," he noted ruefully. While the cabinet members squabbled over patronage, they united in their resentment of Seward's preeminent position. They were irritated that he was the one who called the cabinet into session, and the time he spent with Lincoln inspired jealousy. Finally, with Chase as their spokesman, they requested that cabinet meetings be held at regular times. Lincoln agreed, designating Tuesdays and Fridays at noon. Still, Seward was recognized as the man who had the president's ear. William Russell of the Times in London capitalized on this intimacy when he first arrived in Washington. Russell was then 41, a spectacled, lively, rotund Englishman whose sparkling reports from the Crimean War had made him a celebrity in London. At a dinner party on March 26th, he was fascinated by Seward, a subtle, quick man, rejoicing in power, fond of badinage, bursting with the importance of state mysteries. The next day, Seward arranged for Russell to slip into a White House reception for the Italian minister. Russell recalled that Lincoln put out his hand in a very friendly manner and said, "Mr. Russell, I am very glad to make your acquaintance and to see you in this country. The London Times is one of the greatest powers in the world. In fact, I don't know anything which has much more power, except perhaps the Mississippi." Russell attended the Lincoln's first state dinner that evening. Arriving at the White House, he noted that Mary was already seated to receive her guests. He found her features plain, her nose and mouth of an ordinary type, and her manners and appearance homely, stiffened, however, by the consciousness that her position requires her to be something more than plain Mrs. Lincoln, the wife of the Illinois lawyer. She is profuse in the introduction of the word "sir" in every sentence. Once acquainted with all the cabinet officers and the various guests, Russell rated Chase, with his fine forehead and his face indicating energy and power, as one of the most intelligent and distinguished persons in the whole assemblage. He was particularly taken with Kate Chase, whom he described as very attractive, agreeable, and sprightly. Kate was in her element, talking easily, with a low, melodious voice, her head tilted slightly upward, a faint, almost disdainful smile upon her face, as if she were a titled English lady posing in a formal garden for Gainsborough or Reynolds. As her father's hostess, Kate stood fourth in official Washington society. Her only real rival was Mrs. Lincoln, since neither Ellen Hamlin nor Frances Seward had any desire for social aggrandizement. In reality, there was no one in Washington to compare with Kate Chase, one of Kate's intimate friends later told the Cincinnati Enquirer. She was the queen of society. Men showered adulation upon her and went on their knees to her. I have never seen a woman who has so much personal charm and magnetism. The possibly apocryphal story spread of Kate's introduction to Mary that night. "I shall be glad to see you any time, Miss Chase," Mary said. Kate replied, "Mrs. Lincoln, I shall be glad to have you call on me at any time." Though Mary would later manifest intense jealousy of Kate, it is doubtful that Kate's remark spoiled her pleasure that glittering evening. At the formal dinner, "there was a babel of small talk," Russell observed, "except when there was an attentive silence caused by one of the president's stories, for which he is famous." As he reeled off one humorous anecdote after another, no one could have guessed that earlier that day, Lincoln had received devastating news from General Scott. In a written memorandum, Scott had advised that it was now unlikely, according to recent information from the South, whether the voluntary evacuation of Fort Sumter alone would have a decisive effect upon the states now wavering between adherence to the Union and secession. Fort Pickens would also have to be abandoned, Scott argued, in order to give confidence to the 8 remaining slaveholding states. Shortly before the state dinner ended, Lincoln called his cabinet colleagues aside and asked them to follow him into a different room. Montgomery Blair would long remember Lincoln's agitation as he revealed the contents of Scott's report. "A very oppressive silence succeeded," Blair recalled, interrupted only by his own angry retort that Scott was playing politician and not general, a comment directed at Seward's influence with Scott. Like his son, Blair Sr. had long believed that Lincoln should have announced the reinforcement of Sumter at the time of his inauguration, and he blamed Seward for Lincoln's timid, temporizing policy. It was Andrew Jackson's motto, he reminded, that if you temporize, you are lost. That night, Lincoln was unable to sleep. The time for musing and assessment was at an end. He must make the decision between a surrender that might compromise the honor of the North and tear it apart, or a reinforcement that might carry the country into civil war. Later he confessed to Browning, "Of all the trials I have had since I came here, none begin to compare with those I had between the inauguration and the fall of Fort Sumter. They were so great that could I have anticipated them, I would not have believed it possible to survive them." At noon the next day, the cabinet convened. Lincoln presented all the intelligence he had gathered, including Fox's report on Major Anderson's situation, and Hurlbut's conclusion that Unionism was essentially dead in South Carolina. Once more, the members were asked to submit their opinions in writing. This time, shaped no doubt by Lincoln's presentation and General Scott's disturbing memo, the majority opinion, with only Seward and Smith clearly dissenting, advised that both Sumter and Pickens should be resupplied and reinforced. Evidence suggests that Lincoln had reached a decision before the cabinet met, for he had already requested that Fox send a list of the ships, men, and supplies he would need for his expedition. Several hours after the cabinet adjourned, he also implemented a drastic restructuring of his daily schedule. Much as he wanted to give office seekers their due, he needed time and space to consider the grave problems facing the country. He ordered Nicolay to limit visiting hours from 10 a.m. to 3 p.m., ending the hectic burden of 12-hour days that Nicolay knew would be impossible to sustain for a great length of time. For Seward, Lincoln's decision to reinforce Sumter was shattering. He was in his house on the evening of March 29th when George Harrington, Assistant Secretary of the Treasury, knocked at the door. Harrington had just left the White House, where Wells, Blair, and Fox had met with Lincoln, and it was finally determined, with the President's approval, to reinforce Fort Sumter.
"Thunder, George, what are you talking about?" Seward asked. "It cannot be."
When Harrington repeated his news, Seward was irate.
"I want no more at this time of the administration, which may be defeated. We are not yet in a position to go to war."
Seward's success in getting Lincoln to soften the tone of his inaugural address, coupled with the cabinet vote on March 15th, decisively echoing his own advice to evacuate Sumter, had left him with the mistaken conviction that he was the power behind a weak president. Flattering letters from the South had compounded Seward's erroneous assumption. Frederick Roberts in North Carolina assured him that everyone was looking to him for a peaceful adjustment of the difficulties. While Lincoln, the letter continued, was considered throughout the state as a third-rate man, Seward was looked upon as the Hector or Atlas of not only his cabinet, but the giant intellect of the whole North. Another admirer swore that Unionists look to yourself, and only to you, sir, as a member of the cabinet, to save the country. With these judgments of both the president's failings and his own stature, Seward wholeheartedly agreed. he confided to Adams that Lincoln had no conception of his situation, much absorption in the details of office dispensation, but little application to great ideas. Adams needed little convincing. Despite accepting the high-ranking appointment as minister to Great Britain, he remained dismissive of Lincoln, writing in his diary, "The man is not equal to the hour." The only hope, he repeatedly wrote, lay in the Secretary of State's influence with the president. For weeks, Seward had acted under two supreme illusions. First, that he was in reality the man in charge, and second, that Southerners would be appeased by the abandonment of Sumter and would eventually return to the Union. He had risked his good name on his conviction that Lincoln would follow his advice and surrender Sumter. Three commissioners had been sent to Washington by the Confederacy to negotiate, among other issues, the question of the forts. Lincoln, however, had refused to allow any dealings with them on the grounds that direct communication would legitimize the seceded states. Stifled, Seward had resorted to an indirect link through Alabama's John Campbell, who had remained on the Supreme Court despite the secession of his state. After the March 15th cabinet meeting, Seward, believing that his vote to evacuate would soon be confirmed by Lincoln, had sent a message that Campbell relayed to the commissioners, who reported to the Confederacy's capital, then located in Montgomery, Alabama, Sumter would be evacuated in the next 5 days. Desperate to save his own honor and prevent the country from drifting into war, while the administration established no clear-cut policy, Seward composed an extraordinary memo that would become the source of great criticism and controversy. During the afternoon of April 1st, Fred Seward recalled, his father wrote some thoughts for the president's consideration. Since his handwriting was almost illegible, he asked Fred to copy it over and bring it personally to Lincoln, not allowing it to be filed or to pass into the hands of any clerk. "We are at the end of a month's administration, and yet without a policy, either domestic or foreign," the contentious memo began. Seward proceeded to reiterate his argument for abandoning Fort Sumter, placing new emphasis on reinforcing Fort Pickens. He asserted that focusing on Fort Pickens rather than on Sumter would allow Lincoln to retain the symbolism of federal authority with far less provocation. Seward's mistake was not the diabolical plot that some critics later charged, but a grave misreading of the situation and a grave misunderstanding of Lincoln. Seward continued under the heading of "For Foreign Nations," suggesting that Lincoln deflect attention from the domestic crisis by demanding that Spain and France explain their meddling in the Western Hemisphere, and that Great Britain, Canada, and Russia account for their threats to intervene in the American crisis. If the explanations of any country proved unsatisfactory, war should be declared. In fact, some such explanations were eventually demanded, convincing European leaders to be more careful in their response to the American situation. It was Seward's wilder proposal of declaring war, if necessary, that would arouse the harsh rebuke of biographers and historians. Nor did Seward's overreaching end there. The previous February, Seward had informed a German diplomat that there was no great difference between an elected president of the United States and an hereditary monarch. Neither truly ran things. The actual direction of public affairs belongs to the leader of the ruling party. Seward had conceived of himself as a prime minister, with Lincoln the figurehead. Testing this presumptuous notion, Seward closed with the idea that whatever policy we adopt, there must be an energetic prosecution of it. Either the president must do it himself, or devolve it on some member of his cabinet. It is not in my especial province, but I neither seek to evade nor assume responsibility. As Nicolay later wrote, had Mr. Lincoln been an envious or a resentful man, he could not have wished for a better occasion to put a rival under his feet. Seward's effrontery easily could have provoked a swift dismissal. Yet, as happened so often, Lincoln showed an unselfish magnanimity, which was the central marvel of the whole affair. The president immediately dashed off a reply to Seward that he would never send, probably preferring to respond in person. Buried in Lincoln's papers, the document was not unearthed until decades later, as Nicolay and Hay labored on their massive Lincoln biography. Lincoln's response was short but pointed. Concerning the assertion that the administration was without a policy, Lincoln reminded Seward of his inaugural pledge that the power confided to me will be used to hold, occupy, and possess the property and places belonging to the government. This was the exact domestic policy that Seward called for, with the single exception that it does not propose to abandon Fort Sumter. As for the charge that the administration lacked a foreign policy, we have been preparing circulars and instructions to ministers without even a suggestion that we had no foreign policy. The idea of engineering a foreign war to reunify the country did not even rate a response. Lincoln responded most emphatically to Seward's suggestion that perhaps the Secretary of State was needed to design and pursue a vigorous policy where the president had not. In unmistakable language, Lincoln wrote, "I remark that if this must be done, I must do it." Undaunted, Seward worked furiously to complete his plans for reinforcing Fort Pickens, hopeful that Lincoln might change his mind before the Fox expedition to Fort Sumter was launched. The previous day, he had sent an urgent summons to Captain Montgomery Meigs to come to his house. Recognizing that time was short, Seward requested Meigs to put down upon paper an estimate and project for relieving and holding Fort Pickens, and to bring it to the president's before 4 p.m. Lincoln was happy to receive the army captain's report, though in his mind reinforcing Pickens did not mean choosing between the two garrisons. "Tell Scott," the president said, "that I wish this thing done, and not to let it fail unless he can show that I have refused him something he asked for as necessary. I depend upon you gentlemen to push this thing through." Lincoln was cautioned by Seward that the Army's expedition to Pickens should be kept from naval authorities, given the number of Navy men who were openly disloyal to the Union. Lincoln signed orders on April 1st to Andrew Foote, the commandant of the Navy Yard in Brooklyn, to fit out the Powhatan without delay for a secret mission to Pensacola under the command of Lieutenant David Porter. The Powhatan was the U.S. Navy's most powerful warship. Under no circumstances should the fact that she is fitting out be disclosed to the Navy Department, Lincoln emphasized. Both Navy Secretary Wells and Captain Fox, whose plans for the relief of Sumter depended on the Powhatan, remained unaware of the secret orders. With its mighty guns and 300 sailors, the Powhatan was supposed to play an essential role in backing up the tugboats carrying supplies to Sumter. Lincoln had failed to peruse the orders carefully, and inadvertently assigned the Powhatan simultaneously to both Pickens and Sumter. In the confusion of the first weeks, it was not unusual for Lincoln to sign documents from Seward without reading them. Fred Seward later recalled that when he brought papers over to the White House for signature, Lincoln would say, "Your father says this is all right, does he? Well, I guess he knows. Where do I put my name?" Still ignorant of the mix-up, Wells wrote to Samuel Mercer, the current commander of the Powhatan, on April 5th, instructing him to leave New York with the Powhatan in time to be off Charleston Bar by the morning of the 11th. If the supply boats were permitted to land at Fort Sumter, he should return to New York at once. If their entry was opposed, then the Powhatan and its support ships should be used to open the way. Should the peaceable supply mission fail, a reinforcement of the garrison should be attempted by disposing of your force as needed. The orders from Wells to Mercer were read to the president that same day and authorized. The next day, Lincoln drafted a letter for Cameron to send through a messenger to the governor of South Carolina. I am directed by the President of the United States to notify you to expect an attempt will be made to supply Fort Sumter with provisions only, and that if such attempt be not resisted, no effort to throw in men, arms, or ammunition will be made without further notice. Lincoln had devised a means to separate the peaceful supply mission from the more controversial issue of reinforcement, forging, at least for the record, a final alternative to war. While Lincoln's strategy was creative, its execution was fatally bungled. Learning that the Pickens expedition was embarrassed by conflicting orders from the Secretary of the Navy, Captain Meigs had telegraphed Seward for an explanation. Placed in an awkward situation, Seward knew he would have to reveal the secret Pickens mission to Wells. Sometime after 11 p.m., Seward and Fred took a short walk to the Willard to talk with Wells. Earlier that evening, Wells, assuming that the Powhatan and its accompanying ships had already set sail for Sumter, had congratulated himself on accomplishing so much in such a short time. Seward showed Wells the telegram, explaining that it must relate to the Powhatan, which was now under command of David Porter, and on its way to Pensacola. Wells insisted that was impossible. The Powhatan was the flagship of the mission to Sumter. They decided to consult the president at once. Though midnight was approaching, Lincoln was still awake. Upon hearing the problem, he looked first at one and then the other and declared there was some mistake. Once the error was clear, he told Seward to send Porter a telegram ordering him to return the Powhatan to Mercer without delay, so that the Sumter expedition could proceed. Seward tried to champion the Pickens expedition, but Lincoln was imperative, insisting that the telegram go out that night. To the astonishment of Wells, Lincoln took upon himself the whole blame, said it was carelessness, heedlessness, on his part. He ought to have been more careful and attentive. In fact, Wells continued, Lincoln often declared that he, and not his cabinet, was in fault for errors imputed to them. Seward reluctantly sent the telegram, but Porter had already set sail for Florida. A fast ship was dispatched to catch up with the Powhatan, but when Porter read the telegram, bearing Seward's signature instead of the president's, he continued to Florida, on the assumption that the previous order, signed by the president, had priority. When Gustavus Fox reached Charleston, he spent hours futilely searching for the Powhatan, having no clue the vessel had been misrouted. Nor did he know that Confederate authorities in Montgomery had intercepted his plans and ordered the commander in Charleston, Brigadier General Pierre Beauregard, to attack the fort before the Powhatan and Union convoy were due to arrive. At 3:30 a.m. on April 12th, Beauregard sent a note to Anderson announcing his intent to commence firing in 1 hour. Anderson's small garrison of 60 men returned fire, but were quickly overwhelmed by the Confederate force of 9,000. They had no chance, Fox lamented, without the Powhatan's men, howitzers, and fighting launches. Abner Doubleday, an officer on Anderson's staff, recalled that the conflagration was terrible and disastrous. One-fifth of the fort was on fire, and the wind drove the smoke in dense masses into the angle where we had all taken refuge. 34 hours after the fighting began, Major Anderson surrendered. In a gesture that forever endeared him to the North, he brought his men together and fired a dignified 50-round salute to the shredded American flag before hauling it down and leaving the fort. Incredibly, only one Union soldier died, the result of an accidental explosion of gunpowder during the salute to the flag. Beauregard, who had taught Anderson at West Point and had great respect for him, waited until Anderson had departed before entering the fort, as it would be an unhonorable thing to be present at the humiliation of his friend. Captain Fox was inconsolable. Convinced that his mission would have been successful with the missing Powhatan, he believed that for a failure that was not his fault, he had lost his reputation with the general public. Lincoln once more assumed the blame, assuring him that by an accident for which you were in no wise responsible, and possibly I to some extent was, you were deprived of a war vessel with her men, which you deemed of great importance to the enterprise. I most cheerfully and truly declare that the failure of the undertaking has not lowered you a particle, while the qualities you developed in the effort have greatly heightened you, in my estimation. You and I, he continued, both anticipated that the cause of the country would be advanced by making the attempt to provision Fort Sumter, even if it should fail. And it is no small consolation now to feel that our anticipation is justified by the result. Critics later claimed that Lincoln had maneuvered the South into beginning the war. In fact, he had simply followed his inaugural pledge that he would hold the properties belonging to the government, but beyond what may be necessary to accomplish this, there will be no invasion, no using of force. Fort Sumter could not be held without food and supplies. Had Lincoln chosen to abandon the fort, he would have violated his pledge to the North. Had he used force in any way other than to hold government properties, he would have breached his promise to the South. The Confederates had fired the first shot. A war had begun that no one imagined would last 4 years and cost greater than 600,000 lives, more than the cumulative total of all our other wars from the Revolution to Iraq. The devastation and sacrifice would reach into every community, into almost every family, in a nation of 31.5 million. In proportion to today's population, the number of deaths would exceed 5 million. Chapter 13. The ball has opened. News of the Confederate attack on Fort Sumter spread throughout the North that weekend. Walt Whitman recalled hearing the shouts of newsboys after he emerged from an opera on 14th Street and was strolling down Broadway late Saturday night. At the Metropolitan Hotel, where the great lamps were still brightly blazing, the news was read to a crowd of 30 or 40 suddenly gathered round. More than 20 years later, he could almost see them there now, under the lamps at midnight again. The firing on the flag produced a volcanic upheaval in the North, Whitman observed, which at once substantially settled the question of disunion. The National Intelligencer spoke for many Northerners. Our people now, one and all, are determined to sustain the government and demand a vigorous prosecution of the war inaugurated by the disunionists. All sympathy with them is dead. The fevered excitement in the north was mirrored in the south. "The ball has opened," a dispatch from Charleston, South Carolina, began. "The excitement in the community is indescribable. With the very first boom of the guns, thousands rushed from their beds to the harbor front, and all day every available place has been thronged by ladies and gentlemen viewing the spectacle through their glasses." On Sunday, Lincoln returned from church and immediately called his cabinet into session. He had decided to issue a proclamation to the North, calling out state militias and fixing a time for Congress to reconvene. The number of volunteer soldiers to be requested came under debate. Some wanted 100,000, others 50,000. Lincoln settled on 75,000. The timing of the congressional session also posed a difficult question. While the executive branch needed Congress to raise armies and authorize spending, Lincoln was advised that to wait for many men of many minds to shape a war policy would be to invite disaster. Seward was particularly adamant on this point, believing that history tells us that kings who call extra parliaments lose their heads. Lincoln and his cabinet set the 4th of July as the date for Congress to reconvene, relying on their patriotism to sanction the war measures taken prior to that time by the executive. John Nicolay made a copy of the president's proclamation and delivered it to the Secretary of State, who stamped the Great Seal and sent it for publication the following day. That afternoon, Lincoln took a carriage ride with his boys and Nicolay, trying for a moment to distract himself from the increasingly onerous events. Upon his return, he welcomed his old rival Stephen Douglas for a private meeting of several hours. Douglas was not well. A lifetime of alcohol and frenetic activity had taken its toll. In 2 months' time, he would be dead. Nevertheless, he offered his solid support to Lincoln, afterward publicly declaring himself ready to sustain the president in the exercise of his constitutional functions to preserve the Union and maintain the government. His statement proved tremendously helpful in mobilizing Democratic support. "In this hour of trial, it becomes the duty of every patriotic citizen to sustain the general government," one Douglas paper began. Another urged every man to lay aside his party bias, give up small prejudices, and go in heart and hand to put down treason and traitors. "The response to the proclamation at the North," Fred Seward recalled, "was all or more than could be anticipated. Every governor of a free state promptly promised that his quota should be forthcoming. An enthusiastic outburst of patriotic feeling, an uprising of the North in town and country, was reported by telegraph." Northern newspapers described massive rallies, with bands blaring and volunteers marching in support of the Union. Old party lines seemed to have evaporated. "We begin to look like a united North," George Templeton Strong recorded in his diary, prophesying that the Democratic New York Herald would soon denounce Jefferson Davis as it denounced Lincoln a week ago. The enthusiastic solidarity of the North dangerously underestimated the strength and determination of the South. Seward predicted that the war would be over in 60 days. John Hay expressed the condescending wish that it would be bloody and short, in pity to the maniac South. They are weak, ignorant, bankrupt in money and credit. Their army is a vast mob, insubordinate and hungry. What is before them but defeat, poverty, dissensions, insurrections, and ruin? Ominous signals from the South soon deflated these facile forecasts. North Carolina, Tennessee, and Kentucky refused to send troops for the wicked purpose of subduing their sister Southern states. Then, on April 17th, citing the president's call to arms, the vital state of Virginia seceded from the Union. The historian James Randall would designate this act one of the most fateful events in American history. News of Virginia's decision provoked jubilation throughout the South. "We never saw our population so much excited as it was yesterday afternoon, when the glorious news spread all over town as wildfire, that Virginia, the mother of presidents, had seceded at last," the New Orleans Daily Picayune reported. "Citizens on the sidewalks were shaking each other by the hand. Our office was overcrowded. The boys were running to and fro, unable to restrain their delight, and now and then venting their enthusiasm by giving a hearty hurrah." In their excitement, Southerners fell victim to the same hectic misjudgment that plagued the North, overstating their own chances as they underestimated their opponent's will. "And now we are 8, the Picayune exulted, predicting they would soon be 15 when all the remaining slave states followed Virginia's lead. In fact, the Old Dominion's action prodded only 3 more states to join the Confederacy: North Carolina, Arkansas, and Tennessee. For many agonizing months, however, Lincoln would remain apprehensive about the border states of Maryland, Missouri, and Kentucky. The day after Virginia seceded, Francis Blair Sr. invited Colonel Robert E. Lee to his yellow house on Pennsylvania Avenue. A graduate of West Point, the 54-year-old Lee had served in the Mexican War, held the post of superintendent at West Point, and commanded the forces that captured John Brown at Harper's Ferry. General Scott regarded him as "the very best soldier I ever saw in the field." Lincoln had designated Blair to tender Lee the highest-ranking military position within the president's power to proffer. "I come to you on the part of President Lincoln," Blair began, "to ask whether any inducement that he can offer will prevail on you to take command of the Union Army." Lee responded as candidly and as courteously as he could. "Mr. Blair, I look upon secession as anarchy. If I owned the 4 millions of slaves in the South, I would sacrifice them all to the Union. But how can I draw my sword upon Virginia, my native state?" When the meeting ended, Lee called upon old General Scott to discuss the dilemma further. Then he returned to his Arlington home to think. 2 days later, he contacted Scott to tender his resignation from the U.S. Army. "It would have been presented at once," Lee explained, "but for the struggle it has cost me to separate myself from a service to which I have devoted all the best years of my life and all the ability I possessed. During the whole of that time, more than 30 years, I have experienced nothing but kindness from my superiors and the most cordial friendship from my companions. I shall carry with me to the grave the most grateful recollections of your kind consideration, and your name and fame will always be dear to me." That same day, a distraught Lee wrote to his sister, "Now we are in a state of war which will yield to nothing." Though he could apprehend no necessity for this state of things, and would have forborne and pleaded to the end for redress of grievances, real or supposed, he was unable, he explained, to raise my hand against my relatives, my children, my home. "I have therefore resigned my commission in the army, and save in defense of my native state, with the sincere hope that my poor services may never be needed, I hope I may never be called upon to draw my sword." Shortly thereafter, Lee was designated commander of the Virginia State Forces. While Lee wrestled with the grim personal consequences of his decision, Lincoln's brother-in-law, Benjamin Hardin Helm, confronted a painful decision of his own. Helm, a native of Kentucky and a graduate of West Point, had married Mary's half-sister, Emily, in 1856. While conducting business in Springfield, he had stayed with the Lincolns, According to his daughter Catherine, he and Lincoln formed a friendship which was more like the affection of brothers than the ordinary liking of men. 2 weeks after Sumter, Lincoln brought Helm, a staunch Southern Rights Democrat, into his office. "Ben, here is something for you," Lincoln said, placing a sealed envelope in his hands. "Think it over, and let me know what you will do." The letter offered Helm the rank of major and the prestigious position of paymaster in the Union Army. That afternoon, Helm encountered Lee, whose face betrayed his anxiety. "Are you not feeling well, Colonel Lee?" Helm asked. "Well, in body, but not in mind," Lee replied. "In the prime of life, I quit a service in which were all my hopes and expectations in this world." Helm showed Lee Lincoln's offer and asked for advice, saying, "I have no doubt of his kindly intentions, but he cannot control the elements. There must be a great war." Lee was too much disturbed to render advice, urging Helm to do as your conscience and your honor bid. That night, Emily Helm later recalled, her husband was unable to sleep. The next day he returned to the White House. "I am going home," he told Lincoln. "I will answer you from there. The position you offer me is beyond what I had expected, even in my most hopeful dreams. You have been very generous to me, Mr. Lincoln, generous beyond anything I have ever known. I had no claim upon you, for I opposed your candidacy and did what I could to prevent your election. Don't let this offer be made public yet. I will send you my answer in a few days." When Helm reached Kentucky and spoke with General Simon Bolivar Buckner and his friends, he realized he must decline Lincoln's offer and cast his destinies with his native Southland. The time spent in drafting his reply to Lincoln proved to be, he told a friend, the most painful hour of his life. Soon after, he received a commission in the Confederate Army, where he eventually became a brigadier general. Each day brought new conflicts and decisions as Lincoln struggled to stabilize the beleaguered Union. In a contentious cabinet meeting, Seward argued that a blockade of southern ports should be instituted at once. Recognized by the law of nations, the blockade would grant the Union the power to search and seize vessels. Gideon Welles countered that to proclaim a blockade would mistakenly acknowledge that the Union was engaged in a war with the South, and encourage foreign powers to extend belligerent rights to the Confederacy. Better to simply close the ports against the insurrection and use the policing powers of municipal law to seize entering or exiting ships. The cabinet split down the middle. Chase, Blair, and Bates backed Welles, while Smith and Cameron sided with Seward. Lincoln concluded that Seward's position was stronger and issued his formal blockade proclamation on April 19th. Welles, despite his initial hesitation, would execute the blockade with great energy and skill. The commencement of war found Welles and the Navy Department in a grave situation. Southerners, who had made up the majority of Navy officers in peacetime, resigned in droves every day. Treason was rampant. Early in April, Lincoln had graciously attended a wedding celebration for the daughter of Captain Frank Buchanan, the commandant of the Navy Yard in Washington, D.C. 2 weeks later, expecting that his home state of Maryland would soon secede and join the Confederacy, Buchanan resigned his commission, vowing that he would not take any part in the defense of this yard from this date. Meanwhile, the secession of Virginia jeopardized the Norfolk Navy Yard, with its strategic location, immense dry dock, great supply of cannons and guns, and premier vessel, the Merrimack. The Norfolk Yard was indispensable to both sides. Wells had encouraged Lincoln to reinforce the yard before Sumter fell, but Lincoln had resisted any action that would provoke Virginia. This decision would seriously compromise the Union's naval strength. By the time Wells received orders to send troops to Norfolk, it was too late. The Confederates had secured control of the Navy Yard. The calamitous news, Charles Francis Adams recorded in his diary, sent him into a state of extreme uneasiness about the future of the Union. "We, the children of the third and fourth generations, are doomed to pay the penalties of the compromises made by the first." The first casualties of the war came on April 19, 1861, the same day the blockade was announced. When the 6th Massachusetts Regiment reached Baltimore by rail en route to defend Washington, the men were attacked by a secessionist mob. The scene while the troops were changing cars was indescribably fearful, the Baltimore Sun reported. The enraged crowd, branding the troops "nigger thieves," assaulted them with knives and revolvers. 4 soldiers and 9 civilians were killed. As George Templeton Strong noted in his diary, "It's a notable coincidence that the first blood in this great struggle is drawn by Massachusetts men on the anniversary of the battles of Lexington and Concord that touched off the Revolutionary War." The president immediately summoned the mayor of Baltimore and the governor of Maryland to the White House. Still hoping to keep Maryland in the Union, Lincoln agreed to make no point of bringing further troops through Baltimore, where strident secessionists were concentrated, but insisted that the troops must be allowed to go around Baltimore. Shortly after midnight, an angry committee of delegates from Baltimore arrived at the White House to confront Lincoln. John Hay took them to see Cameron, but kept them from the president until morning. The delegation demanded that troops be kept not only out of Baltimore, but out of the entire state of Maryland. Lincoln adamantly refused to comply. "I must have troops to defend this capital," he replied. "Geographically, it lies surrounded by the soil of Maryland. Our men are not moles and can't dig under the earth. They are not birds and can't fly through the air. There is no way but to march across, and that they must do." The day the war claimed its first casualties was also the day when the censorship of the press was exercised for the first time at the telegraph office, a veteran journalist recalled. When correspondents wished to telegraph the lists of the dead and wounded of the Massachusetts 6th, they found a squad of the National Rifles in possession of the office, with orders to permit the transmission of no messages. Infuriated, the correspondents rode to Seward's house to complain. The Secretary of State argued that if they sent accounts of the killed and wounded, they would only influence public sentiment and be an obstacle in the path of reconciliation. The issue became moot when reporters learned that secessionists had cut all the telegraph wires in Baltimore and demolished all the railroad bridges surrounding the city. Washington was isolated from all communication with the North. For the next week, with wires cut and mail stopped, the residents of Washington lived in a state of constant fear. Visitors abandoned the great hotels. Stores closed. Windows and doors were barricaded. Literally, Villard noted, it was as though the government of a great nation had been suddenly removed to an island in mid-ocean in a state of entire isolation. Anxious citizens crowded the train station every day, hopeful to greet an influx of the northern troops needed to protect the vulnerable city. Rumors spread quickly. Across the Potomac, the campfires of the Confederate soldiers were visible. It appeared they were ready to lay siege to Washington. Waiting for the attack, War Secretary Cameron slept in his office. "Here we were in this city," Nicolay wrote his fiancée, "in charge of all the public buildings, property, and archives, with only about 2,000 reliable men to defend it. Elsewhere in the North, anxiety was nearly as great. "No dispatches from Washington," Strong reported from New York. "People talked darkly of its being attacked before our reinforcements come to the rescue, and everyone said we must not be surprised by news that Lincoln and Seward and all the administration are prisoners." Kate and Nettie Chase were in New York visiting Chase's wealthy friend Hiram Barney, who had received the powerful post of collector of customs in New York. Reflecting a general fear that the rebels are at Washington or near it, Barney insisted that the girls stay in New York until the capital was out of danger. For Kate, so passionately attached to her father, these were difficult hours. "I can see that Kay is anxious for her father," Barney wrote Chase. "It may be seen in many ways, in spite of her efforts to be calm and conceal it." Kate leaped at the chance to accompany Major Robert Anderson, who had just arrived in New York from Fort Sumter and was heading to Washington to report to the president. The little party made its way to Philadelphia and then caught a steamer from Perryville to Annapolis, bypassing the blocked railroad tracks in Baltimore. En route, however, they were approached by an enemy vessel, which fired a warning shot. Fearing that the Confederates had intelligence that Anderson was on board and were intending to capture him, the captain placed a cannon in position and crowded on steam. While Kate and Nettie remained below, with the hatches closed, the steamer churned ahead, eventually gaining enough ground that its adversary ran up a black flag, changed her course, and was soon out of sight. From Annapolis, they reached Washington and were reunited with their relieved father. These were terrible days of suspense for the Seward family in Auburn as well. Young Will Seward, now 22, made nightly forays to the local telegraph office, hoping in vain for news from his father. In daily letters, Frances entreated her husband to let her join him. "It is hard to be so far from you when your life is in danger," she pleaded. No reply came to her appeal. In public, Lincoln maintained his calm, but the growing desperation of the government's position filled him with dread. Late one night, after a day of gloom and doubt, John Hay saw him staring out the window in futile expectation of the troops promised by various northern states, including New York, Rhode Island, and Pennsylvania. "Why don't they come?" he asked. "Why don't they come?" The next day, visiting the injured men of the Massachusetts 6th, he was heard to say, "I don't believe there is any North. The 7th Regiment, from New York, is a myth. Rhode Island is not known in our geography any longer. You, Massachusetts men, are the only Northern realities." For days, the rioting in Baltimore continued. Fears multiplied that the Maryland legislature, which had convened in Annapolis, was intending to vote for secession. The cabinet debated whether the president should bring in the army to arrest or disperse the members of that body. Lincoln decided that it would not be justifiable. It was a wise determination, for in the end, though secessionist mobs continued to disrupt the peace of Maryland for weeks, the state never joined the Confederacy, and eventually became, as Lincoln predicted, the first of the redeemed. Receiving word that the mobs intended to destroy the train tracks between Annapolis and Philadelphia in order to prevent the long-awaited troops from reaching the beleaguered capital, Lincoln made a controversial decision. If resistance along the military line between Washington and Philadelphia made it necessary to suspend the writ of habeas corpus for the public safety, Lincoln authorized General Scott to do so. In Lincoln's words, General Scott could arrest and detain, without resort to the ordinary processes and forms of law, such individuals as he might deem dangerous to the public safety. Seward later claimed that he had urged a wavering Lincoln to take this step, convincing him that perdition was the sure penalty of further hesitation. There may be truth in this, for Seward was initially put in charge of administering the program. Lincoln had not issued a sweeping order, but a directive confined to this single route. Still, by rescinding the basic constitutional protection against arbitrary arrest, he aroused the wrath of Chief Justice Taney, who was on circuit duty in Maryland at the time. Ruling in favor of one of the prisoners, John Merryman, Taney blasted Lincoln and maintained that only Congress could suspend the writ. Attorney General Bates, though reluctant to oppose Taney, upheld Lincoln's suspension. Over a period of weeks, he drafted a 26-page opinion, arguing that in a time like the present, when the very existence of the nation is assailed by a great and dangerous insurrection, the president has the lawful discretionary power to arrest and hold in custody persons known to have criminal intercourse with the insurgents. Lincoln later defended his decision in his first message to Congress. As chief executive, he was responsible for ensuring that the laws be faithfully executed. An insurrection in nearly one-third of the states had subverted the whole of the laws. Are all the laws but one to go unexecuted, and the government itself go to pieces, lest that one be violated? His logic was unanswerable, but as Supreme Court Justice Thurgood Marshall argued in another context many years later, the grave threats to liberty often come in times of urgency when constitutional rights seem too extravagant to endure. Wells seemed to understand the complex balancing act, correctly predicting to his wife that the government will doubtless be stronger after the conflict is over than it has ever been, and there will be less liberty. Finally, after a week of mounting uneasiness, the 7th Regiment of New York arrived in Washington. The New York Times reported that the steps and balconies of the hotels, the windows of the private houses, the doorways of the stores, and even the roofs of many houses were crowded with men, women, and children, shouting and waving handkerchiefs and flags. In the days that followed, more regiments arrived. Mary and her friends watched the regimental parades from a window in the mansion. The presence of the troops considerably lightened Lincoln's mood. He blithely told John Hay that in addition to assuring the safety of the Capitol, he would eventually go down to Charleston and pay her the little debt we are owing her. Hay was so happy to hear these words that he felt like letting off an Illinois yell. Frances Seward was greatly relieved when she received a letter from her husband confirming that more than 8,000 troops were in Washington. He did not, however, grant her request to join him there. His daughter-in-law, Anna, had almost completed decorating their new house on Lafayette Square. The carpets were down, and hundreds of books already lined the library shelves. They would move in at the end of April. Unlike Frances, Anna loved the bustle of Seward's life. "For 6 or 8 nights we had visitors at all hours," she cheerfully reported. Perhaps Seward, anticipating the trials such a hectic environment would cause his wife, deemed it better for her to stay in their tranquil house in Auburn. Furthermore, he knew they would argue about the purpose of the war. Frances, unlike her husband, had already decided that the principal goal was to end slavery. She recognized that the war might last years and entail immense sacrifice of human life, but the eradication of slavery justified it all. "The true, strong, glorious North is at last fairly roused," she wrote her husband. "The enthusiasm of the people, high and low, rich and poor, all enlisted at last in the cause of human rights. No concession from the South now will avail to stem the torrent. No compromise will be made with slavery of black or white. God has heard the prayer of the oppressed, and a fearful retribution awaits the oppressors." In her all-embracing vision of the war, Frances stood at this point in opposition not only to her husband, but to most of the cabinet and a substantial majority of Northerners. Still certain it would be a quick war with an easy reconciliation, Seward told a friend, "There would be no serious fighting after all. The South would collapse and everything be serenely adjusted." Bates wanted a limited war so as to disturb as little as possible the accustomed occupations of the people, including Southern slaveholding. Blair agreed, counseling Lincoln that it would be a fatal error if the contest became one between the whole people of the South and the people of the North. To Lincoln's mind, the battle to save the Union contained an even larger purpose than ending slavery, which was, after all, sanctioned by the very Constitution he was sworn to uphold. "I consider the central idea pervading this struggle," he told Hay in early May, "is the necessity that is upon us of proving that popular government is not an absurdity. We must settle this question now, whether in a free government the minority have the right to break up the government whenever they choose. If we fail, it will go far to prove the incapability of the people to govern themselves." The philosopher John Stuart Mill shared Lincoln's spacious understanding of the sectional crisis, predicting that a Southern victory would give courage to the enemies of progress and damp the spirits of its friends all over the civilized world. From the opposite point of view, a member of the British nobility expressed the hope that with the dissolution of the Union, men would live to see an aristocracy established in America. In his farewell address, George Washington had given voice to this transcendent idea of union. "It is of infinite moment," George Washington said, "that you should properly estimate the immense value of your national union to your collective and individual happiness, that you should cherish a cordial, habitual, and immovable attachment to it, accustoming yourselves to think and speak of it as of the palladium of your political safety and prosperity." Foreseeing the potential for dissension, Washington advised vigilance against the first dawning of every attempt to alienate any portion of our country from the rest, or to enfeeble the sacred ties which now link together the various parts. It was this mystical idea of popular government and democracy that propelled Abraham Lincoln to call forth the thousands of soldiers who would rise up to defend the sacred union created by the Founding Fathers. In the days before the troops arrived, rumors spread that the White House would be targeted for a direct attack. Late one evening, an agitated visitor arrived to inform the president that a mortar battery has been planted on the Virginia Heights commanding the town. John Hay recorded in his diary that he had to do some very dexterous lying to calm the awakened fears of Mrs. Lincoln in regard to the assassination suspicion. Only when troops appeared in force was she able to relax. "Thousands of soldiers are guarding us," she wrote a friend in Springfield, "and if there is safety in numbers, we have every reason to feel secure." Mary's cousin, Elizabeth Grimsley, was equally relieved. "The intense excitement has blown over," she told a friend. "Washington is very quiet and pleasant. We enjoy the beautiful drives around the city." With little understanding of the peril threatening the city and their well-being, Willie and Tad found the period of Washington's isolation exhilarating. Tad boasted at Sunday school that he had no fear of the plug uglies, as the rowdy secessionists in Baltimore were called. "You ought to see the fort we've got on the roof of our house. Let 'em come. Willie and I are ready for 'em." Though the fort consisted of only a small log, symbolizing a cannon, and several decommissioned rifles, the Lincoln boys developed elaborate plans to defend the White House from the roof. And they loved visiting the troops quartered in the East Room of the White House and in the Capitol, where Hay noted the contrast between the gray-haired dignity that had previously prevailed in the Senate and the young soldiers, scattered over the desks, chairs, and galleries, some loafing, many writing letters, slowly and with plow-hardened hands. The Taft boys and their 16-year-old sister, Julia, were now almost daily guests at the White House. Like Willie, Bud was rather pale and languid, not very robust, but a pretty good student. Holly, as described by his father, Judge Taft, resembled Tad, all motion and activity, never idle, impatient of restraint, quick to learn when he tries, impetuous, all go-ahead. In Bud and Holly, Willie and Tad each found a best friend. Julia, meanwhile, formed a friendship with Mary Lincoln. For the rest of her life, Julia retained warm memories of both the First Lady and the President. More than once, she recalled, Mary had said to her, "I wish I had a little girl like you, Julia." Mary even shared her memories of the death of her son Edward, and they wept together. In the evenings, when the President unwound in the family sitting room, the four boys would beg him to tell a story. Julia long remembered the scene as the President launched into one of his amusing tales. Tad perched precariously on the back of the big chair, Willie on one knee, Bud on the other, both leaning against him, while Holly sat on the arm of the chair. As a proper young lady, Julia was appalled by some of the boys' antics. She refused to join in when she found the four of them sitting on the President, attempting to pin him to the floor. She was embarrassed when they interrupted cabinet meetings to invite members and the President to attend one of their theatrical performances in the attic. Though Lincoln himself never seemed to mind, taking great pleasure in their fun, Julia felt she was responsible for curbing their youthful exuberance. Sometimes Willie would help to restore order. He was, Julia wrote, the most lovable boy she had ever known, bright, sensible, sweet-tempered, and gentle-mannered. More often he would simply retreat to his mother's room, where he loved to read poetry and write verses. Despite Julia's great affection for Mary, she was stunned by the First Lady's overbearing need to get what she wanted when she wanted it, regardless of how others might be hurt or inconvenienced. A curious example of such behavior took place when Julia's mother attended a White House concert, decked out in one of her fashionable bonnets. When Mary greeted her, she looked closely at the beautiful purple strings on the bonnet, and then took Mrs. Taft aside. Watching the scene, Julia was puzzled at the look of amazement on her mother's face, not fathoming why she should look so surprised at a passing compliment. It turned out that Mary's milliner had created a purple-trimmed bonnet but lacked sufficient purple ribbon for the strings. Mary hoped to acquire Mrs. Taft's purple strings. Few recognized the insecurity behind Mary's outlandish behavior, the terrible needs behind the ostentation and apparent abrasiveness. While initially thrilled to move into the White House, Mary soon found herself in the compromising situation of having one full brother, three half-brothers, and three brothers-in-law in the Confederate Army. From the start, she was not fully trusted in the North. As the wife of President Lincoln, she was vilified in the South. As a Westerner, she did not meet the standards of Eastern society. Feeling pressure on all sides, she was determined to present herself as an accomplished and sophisticated woman, in short, the most elegant and admired lady in Washington. Driven by the need to prove herself to society, Mary Lincoln became obsessed with recasting her own image and renovating that of her new home, the White House. Unattended for years, the White House had come to look like an old and unsuccessful hotel. Elizabeth Grimsley was stunned to find that the family apartments were in a deplorably shabby condition as to furniture, which looked as if it had been brought in by the First President. The public rooms, too, were in poor shape, with threadbare tobacco-stained rugs, torn curtains, and broken chairs. The sorry condition of the White House provided the energetic Mary with a worthy ambition. She would restore the people's home to its former elegance as a symbol of her husband's strength and the Union's power. In another era, this ambition might have been applauded, but in the midst of a civil war, it was regarded as frivolous. In the middle of May, Mary went on a shopping trip to Philadelphia and New York, taking along her cousin Elizabeth Grimsley and William Wood, the Commissioner of Public Buildings. Having discovered that each president was allotted a $20,000 allowance to maintain the White House, she bought new furniture, elegant curtains, and expensive carpets for the public rooms to replace their worn predecessors. For the state guest room, she purchased what later became known as the Lincoln Bed, an 8-foot-long rosewood bedstead with an ornate headboard carved with exotic birds, grapevines, and clusters of grapes. Again, merchants at the clothing stores were more than willing to extend the First Lady credit. The press exaggerated her shopping spree, claiming she had purchased thousands of dollars of merchandise in stores she had never even visited. Exaggeration notwithstanding, when she returned to Washington, the bills added up. She received a $7,500 invoice for curtain material and trimmings, and owed $900 for a new carriage. And the redecorating process to make the nation's house a fit emblem for the country and for herself had just begun. Never one to be outdone, Kate Chase was hard at work decorating her father's new home, a large 3-story brick mansion at 6th and E Street Northwest. Though the Secretary of the Treasury worried constantly about money, he understood the importance of having an elegant home with expansive public rooms appropriate for entertaining senators, congressmen, diplomats, and generals. In the years ahead, he intended to gather friends and associates who would be ready to back him when the time came for the next presidential election. The lease on the house came to $1,200 a year. When the furnishing costs were added on, Chase found himself in debt. Unable to sell off his Cincinnati and Columbus properties in the depressed real estate market that prevailed in Ohio, he was forced to borrow $10,000 from his old friend Hiram Barney. It must have been painfully awkward for the straight-laced model of probity to request the loan, particularly since Barney, as collector of customs in New York, was technically his subordinate. Nevertheless, Chase persuaded himself that a person in his position, who had given so much to the public for so many years, deserved to live in a distinguished home. So, like Mary Lincoln, Kate traveled to New York and Philadelphia to purchase carpets, draperies, and furniture. The house, complete with 6 servants, would prove perfect for entertaining, although Chase later complained that the distance from the White House, in comparison with Seward's new lodgings at Lafayette Square, denied him an equal intimacy with the president. He apparently never considered that Lincoln might simply find Seward more lively and amiable company. None of her father's social demeanor or leaden eminence hindered Kate. As the mistress of his Washington household, she managed, in a single season, to be as much at home in the society of the national capital as if she had lived there for a lifetime. Dozens of young men paid court to her. A contemporary reporter noted that no other maiden in Washington had more suitors at her feet. Yet, he continued, it was early noticed that among all the young men who flocked to the Chase home, and who were eager to obey her slightest nod, there was not one who seemed to obtain even the remotest hold upon her affections. Until Rhode Island's young governor, William Sprague, came to Washington and drew her attention. Kate had first met the fabulously wealthy Sprague, whose family owned one of the largest textile manufacturing establishments in the country, the previous September in Cleveland. Sprague had come to Ohio at the head of an official delegation to dedicate a statue of Rhode Island native Commodore Oliver Perry, which was to be placed in the public square. Introduced at the festive ball that followed the ceremony, the two immediately hit it off. "For the rest of the evening," one observer recalled, "whenever we saw one of them, we were pretty sure to see the other." For his part, Sprague would never forget his first sight of Kate, dressed in that celebrated dress, "when you became my gaze and the gaze of all observers, and you left the house taking with you my admiration and my appreciation, but more than all, my pulsations." I remember well how I was possessed that night and the following day. Years later, he assured her he could recall the sensation better than if it was yesterday. 10 years Kate's senior, William Sprague had assumed responsibility for the family business at an early age. When William was 13, his father, Amasa Sprague, was shot down on the street as he walked home from his cotton mill one evening. The elder Sprague had been involved in a nasty fight over the renewal of a liquor license. The owner of the gin mill shut down by Sprague was arrested and hanged for the murder. Control of the company passed to William's uncle, who determined that young William should cut short his education to learn the business from the bottom up. "I was thrust into the counting room, performing its lowest drudgeries, raising myself to all of its highest positions," he later recalled. When his uncle died of typhoid fever, William, at 26, took over. As the largest employer in Rhode Island, with more than 10,000 workers, young Sprague wielded enormous political influence. He capitalized on his resources when he ran for governor in 1860, and won on the Democratic ticket, spending over $100,000 of his own money. After the attack on Fort Sumter, Sprague organized the 1st Rhode Island Regiment, providing the state with a loan of $100,000 to outfit the troops, while his brother supplied the artillery battery with 96 horses. When the lavishly supplied volunteer regiment arrived in the threatened capital, the men were received as heroes. On April 29th, the regiment was officially sworn in before the President and General Scott after a dress parade from its headquarters at the Patent Office to the White House. The entire street was filled with spectators from 7th to 9th Street, the Evening Star reported, and many were the complimentary remarks made by the multitude upon the general appearance and movements of the regiment. All the members of the cabinet were present at the ceremony, joining in the rousing greeting for the resplendent troops. Though Sprague stood only 5 feet 6 inches tall, his military uniform and his yellow-plumed hat undoubtedly increased his stature. John Hay commented after meeting the young man with brown wavy hair, gray eyes, and a thin mustache, that while he appeared at first a small, insignificant youth who bought his place, he is certainly all right now. He is very proud of his company, of its wealth and social standing. Hay, too, was impressed by the number of eminent young men in Sprague's regiment. "When men like these leave their horses, their women, and their wine, harden their hands, eat crackers for dinner, wear a shirt for a week, and never black their shoes, all for a principle, it is hard to set any bounds to the possibilities of such an army." Washingtonians nicknamed the 1st Rhode Island the Millionaire's Regiment and dubbed Sprague the most eligible bachelor in the city. It was only a matter of days before Sprague called on Kate. Unlike earlier tentative suitors, intimidated perhaps by Kate's beauty and brains, Sprague